Everyone got busy, and soon the cabin was cleaned of human debris, and a brisk fire was blazing just outside the front door, the smoke trailing up to vanish into the foggy sky. In short order, the interior was warm and dry, and Christy started cooking. Wisely, Jack and Mildred decided to take no chance on any split firewood, and gathered only the already burned timbers from the other cabins. Any dangerous chemicals in that wood should have been completely burned off long ago. With Ryan standing guard, JB had rigged a tripwire across the opening in the Ville wall, each end attached to a lead pipe bomb filled with bent nails as shrapnel. Anything or anyone trying to come through the wall was going to be removed from this plane of existence. Then they had laid a spare gun on top of the sandbag nest and wired it to another pipe bomb. Anyone trying to night creep the Ville would grab the invaluable item, and his or her violent demise would give the companions plenty of notice that trouble had arrived. Dinner was simple, just some MRE food packs, a few self-heat cans of tomato soup, and plenty of coffee. Since Ryan and JB rigged the trap at the front gate, Doc took the first shift of standing guard. During the meal, the companions asked Liana 1,000 questions about North Pointville and the best way to acquire a boat. In the end, they decided that the wisest choice was to simply jack one from the docks and then head due south. Thunder Bay in Canada was just a dozen or so miles to the north, a lot closer than the United States, but that direction was also where the Kraken came from, and no one traveling north had ever come back. The Upper Peninsula of Michigan was about 300 miles to the southeast, and the city of Kalkaska only a few additional miles over land, but that would be a lot safer than trying to sneak past an underwater mutiny that was larger than an ocean liner.
We'll head south after first returning to the Harrington to get more brass and weapons. If we do encounter a bastard Kraken, then I want some heavy iron on our side, for at least a fighting chance at survival.
No matter how big, one implode grain will chill anything.
I also recall seeing some Law rocket launchers in the hold. If they're still good, we should hopefully be able to blast through anything in our way.
Hopefully being the key word.
They are here!
Ryan charged out of the log cabin, the rest of the companions following close behind. The night air grew cold fast away from the crackling flames, and now they could see the black silhouette of Doc standing on top of the sandbag nest. The scholar looked like he had gone insane, waving his arms as if assailed by a swarm of invisible hornets. Then, something large jumped past Doc. The two silhouettes intertwined for a split second before the man fired both of his hand cannons. The fiery light of the double muzzle flash highlighted a cougar, even as the furry body crumpled sideways from the point-blank impact.
It's the cats!
Swinging up the Uzi, JB took careful aim and put a long burst of 9mm parabellum rounds into the shadows below the scholar. Numerous dark shapes raced away from Doc, spreading out in several directions.
They strike from behind!
Doc triggered both the Lamah and the Ruger. The twin stilettos of flame stabbed downward to briefly engulf the head of a cat before it exploded. Then a dozen shapes erupted from the overlapping shadows of the ruined Ville, streaking low and fast across the weedy ground.
Aim for the shoulders!
Liana fired at a shape in the gloom, but there was no response.
Drive bone splinters into their heart! Skull's too thick!
Jack fired his Colt Python and the para ordnance. Something jumped near a tilting woodpile and vanished inside a badly damaged log cabin. Even if there had been only one of the cats, Jack knew better than to follow any night hunter into close confines, where its agility, teeth, and claws gave the beast a killing advantage. Then inspiration hit, and Jack kicked at a loose ribcage on the ground, sending it flying through the sagging window. A split second later, Jack fired both weapons at the open doorway. Although it was clearly hit, Jack strongly doubted that the big cat was really dead.
Fuck aiming for the shoulders! Go for the big three!
Ryan continued firing steadily at the speedy animals. Hit smack in the open mouth, a cougar jerked aside, blood gushing from the terrible wound.
He means eyes, mouth, throat, Liana.
As the monster cats crossed a pool of moonlight, JB had spotted an odd discoloration across the shoulders of each cougar and guessed it was some sort of crude armor, probably just leather and wood, to protect their vulnerable spot. He had hit one cat several times already, and the 9mm rounds had scored only minor flesh wounds.
Form a circle!
Quickly putting their backs to one another, the companions formed a circle and started firing into the darkness, aiming slightly ahead of any movements in the dense shadows. One cougar was dead, then another wounded, and the rest of the animals retreated slightly, then began to race around the companions, using the ruins as cover.
Millie, on my right!
JB fired to the left. Pivoting in that direction, Mildred cut loose with both of her guns, and a cougar staggered from the small caliber wounds. It didn't stop. Letting the empty Beretta fall away, Mildred assumed a two-handed grip on the Czech ZKR and held her breath, waiting patiently, listening to the sounds of the night as the deadly beast came ever closer to finally enter the reddish light of the dying campfire. The cat dropped in its tracks, a neat hole in its head oozing blood. JB killed three more of the beasts.
How many of these fuckers are there?
How the hell should I know?
Ryan triggered the Steyr directly into the face of a hidden cougar. Unexpectedly, a cougar lunged for Jack from inside the burned-out ruin of a cabin, just as he was dropping the magazine from the para-ordnance. Spinning, the teenager put his last round from the Colt Python into the animal, driving it back toward the sandbag nest. Then he threw the empty para-ordnance. Tumbling through the darkness, Jack unerringly hit the tripwire for the second pipe bomb, and the night came alive with the explosion. Bloody chunks of the cat flew in every direction. As if summoned by the blood offering, another cougar erupted from the pool and streaked toward the companions. Christy, Mildred, and Liana all tried to shoot the beast, but in spite of its huge size, the creature moved incredibly fast and proved almost impossible to track. Training the Uzi on the thing, JB hit it twice, but it only darted away, seemingly immune to the pain. Trying to target the cat, Ryan noticed its odd demeanor. Its eyes were forced wide open, but its ears drooped, the tail lashing about insanely, and white foam was dribbling from the black lips. The cougar had to have drunk some of the poisoned water. The cat was dying, but for the moment it was feeling no pain, not even bullet hits, and before it keeled over, the creature could easily take several of the companions along with it. Ryan worked the bolt on the Steyr several times, jacking out the live rounds, then dry-fired the trigger. As Ryan had expected, the trained cougar immediately charged for the supposedly unarmed victim. For a split second, Ryan considered going for the Desert Eagle, then realized he'd never get it out in time. Backing away as if frightened, Ryan waited until the very last second, then thrust the Steyr forward like a spear, the barrel punching into the chest of the beast like an awl. The big cat clawed for the two legs so temptingly out of reach, the sharp fangs snapping for the hands holding the weapon.
Kill the fucker!
Incredibly, Ryan lifted the Steyr higher so that the cat hung suspended from the end of the rifle like a fish on a spear. Confused for only a moment, the cat swung its hind legs forward and slashed bloody furrows across Ryan's shirt. Red blood welling from the deep scratches. In ragged unison, the rest of the companions tore the animal to pieces under a concentrated barrage of hot lead. The tattered body finally went limp and slid from the barrel to the ground.
Tough. Tough bastard.
Ryan went deathly pale and dropped to the ground.
Lover!
Christy rushed closer to kneel alongside him. She rolled him over and inspected the scratches across his chest. It was as she had feared. Some of the water from the fur had to have gotten into the cuts.
Give me your canteens!
Mildred poured the contents of her container across Ryan's muscular chest. The water sluiced away the blood and sweat, revealing four straight lines, the puckered flesh already turning an angry yellow in color. The physician tried not to curse at the sight. The mushrooms were mutations. Every treatment she had for a psilocybin overdose might cure Ryan or kill him instantly. But with no other choice, she had to go with her best guess. Running past the sizzling campfire, the rest of the companions dashed into the log cabin where they had made camp and soon returned with their canteens. Carefully, the precious water was poured over the cuts, while Mildred kneaded Ryan's flesh with her fingertips to try to force out every drop of the mushroom alkaloids that she could. When there was no more, Mildred added the small bottle of witch hazel from her med kit, just in case the dirty claws of the cougar had been carrying any infections. The witch hazel would also help neutralize the alkaloids of the mushrooms. Studying Ryan, Mildred kept any expression from her face. Water and witch hazel. It wasn't much, but there was nothing else to do.
Was it enough?
Maybe. I don't know yet.
Peeling back an eyelid, Mildred checked Ryan's pupil, and her frown told the others that she didn't like what she found.
John, give me a grenade.
What do you want?
Now, John!
Rummaging in his munitions bag, JB unearthed the feral sphere of a Gren and quickly passed it over. Mildred looked at the deadly explosive charge for only a moment, before working on the retaining ring around the neck, and then carefully removing the detonator assembly on top. Setting that aside, Mildred dug inside the open sphere with a knife and extracted a small wad of gray clay. Using a handkerchief, The physician slipped it off the blade and rolled the material into a small pellet, then tucked it under the tongue of the unconscious man. Almost instantly, his face began to flush deep red, and his breathing quickened. Mildred checked the pulse in Ryan's throat.
What'd that do?
Grins use C4 plastic explosive as the main charge, and that's made mostly of nitroglycerin. We got most of the poison off his skin. Now we only have to deal with what got into his bloodstream. He'll have a monster of a headache, but the nitro should keep his heart pumping until the effects of these muting mushrooms pass.
Unfortunately, we have more trouble coming. According to Liana, it seems that these hunting cats are always accompanied by mounted sectmen. They should be here any minute.
No, we use the pass. They go around the mountain.
That'll buy us an hour or more, but nowhere near enough time to run away on foot.
Who said anything about running? How many can we expect?
Baron Griffin issues a hand of cats for each sectmen.
Liana held her hand out, splaying her fingers. It took a minute before everyone understood that the former slave couldn't count.
Oh, okay. Five cats for each sectmen means there are maybe six armed riders coming hard and fast.
Or more. Sometimes they also send along newbies to learn.
All right, then. Pull out your knives and let's start cutting.
Working with a will, the companions got busy hacking and slashing at the dead cougars, blood and fur going everywhere. Ryan awoke with a start, memories of the past few days flooding back. The last thing he clearly recalled was a cougar clawing at his chest, the pain fading into an oddly pleasant sensation. And then everything went crazy, colors becoming tastes, sounds turning into colors, and then total chaos filled the world.
Drugged.
That was the only possible answer. Ryan massaged his temples. Some of that poisoned water had to have gotten into his cuts and knocked him out. He could vaguely remember weird dreams. At least everything seemed back to normal again. Thick furs and pre-dark army blankets lay under him as a crude bed. He was tucked into the corner of a large wooden room. There was a large Franklin stove in the middle of the room, jointed pipes on top carrying the smoke outside through a hole in the roof, and wonderful waves of heat were radiating outward from the cast iron antique. Soft light was streaming in through the glass windows, and there was a large metal desk sitting kitty-corner across the room, a gooseneck lamp on top, as well as a small computer and piles of yellow paper. A wheeled chair sat partially behind the desk, the green leather cover badly ripped, tufts of yellow foam padding sticking out randomly. Clearly, this was some sort of an office. But where were his companions? Through the window, he could see a large campfire blazing. An aluminum pot that he recognized was suspended over the flames, the contents bubbling steadily. But there was no sign of the others. Rising stiffly, Ryan checked for his weapons and found they were gone. Cold adrenaline flooded him, but then he saw his guns and the panga lying on top of the desk, along with his backpack, coat, and canteen.
Okay. I'm not a prisoner. That's good to know.
Shuffling across the room, Ryan suddenly noticed the awful taste in his mouth. Reaching the desk, he quickly checked his weapons, finding everything clean, sharpened, oiled, and fully loaded. Strapping on his gun belt, Ryan then screwed the cap off the canteen and poured some of the contents into his palm. It looked and smelled like water, so he took a lick and was delighted to find that was exactly what it was. Taking a small mouthful, he sloshed the fluid around for about a minute, then spat it out into the wastebasket before taking an equally small sip. It deliciously eased down his dry throat and spread across his empty stomach like a healing balm. Resisting the urge to drink more immediately, Ryan waited a minute to make sure his guts would keep the water down. Then he started sipping and pausing again and again, slowly letting his tissues absorb the water until the hunger pangs eased and the foul taste in his mouth noticeably lessened. Quickly opening the backpack, Ryan found some self-heats and yanked off the lid of one to drink cold soup straight from the can. Ryan was finished long before the container grew warm, and he tossed it into the wastebasket. Feeling greatly refreshed, Ryan wiped his mouth on a sleeve and found a heavy beard on his face. His fingers checked the length, and he guessed that at least 3 days had passed since the fight at Hillville.
Nice to see you again, lover.
About time you got up. For a while there, we were afraid that you were taking the last train west.
Indeed, sir. If the good doctor had not forced all of the blueberry juice down your throat, I do believe you may have never returned from the arms of Morpheus.
Why are you feeding me juice?
For the vitamin C. It helps counter the ravages of the hallucinogenic compounds. Let me check your pulse.
95 beats per minute, she observed. His blood pressure felt high, but that was understandable considering the circumstances. Then she inspected his eye for any dilation or discoloration.
Liana showed us where to find the fruit. The island's lousy with food if you know where to look.
Knowledge is power.
I sang for you, trying to show the way home, but you were lost deep in the nightscape of the dream world.
Got that right. But thanks for trying.
Kin helps kin.
Kin helps kin.
Liana burst into a wide grin and hitched up her gun belt. Half of the ammo they had originally given her was gone, and there were three small notches on the wooden grip of her pistol. The former slave had also put on a few pounds since they had found her, all of it in the right places, and there were wildflowers tucked into her long hair, the bright yellow and blues reflected in the luxurious platinum waves.
What is this place?
Museum. There used to be a copper mine here, but it got nuked, and now it's hotter than a Washington hole, if you can believe that. The rad counters went crazy as we came out of the valley, but we're safe enough here.
And it's triple sure that no Sekhmen or cats are going to be coming after us through the pass. They might go around, but according to Liana, that'll take them days on foot.
Good to know. Well, is there anything here we could use?
Just some pamphlets that'll serve as toilet paper and a couple of oil lanterns without any oil. Along with a med kit with only some bandages left and some lead plumbing that we yanked out of the walls.
The Sekhmen were carrying exploding lances, sir. According to Liana, they detonate when stabbed into a target. John Barrymore simply emptied out the powder and filled several sections of the plumbing to make us a dozen new pipe bombs of frightening power.
They'll do the trick.
Sounds good.
Walking to the door, Ryan studied the rolling landscape. Nukescaping, without a doubt. There were misty mountains rising to the clouds in every direction, and one big waterfall situated off toward the setting sun.
Where are we now? This isn't Hillville, that's for sure.
No, we left there right after the fight. This is about 50 miles into the Crown Mountains, smack in the middle of Royal Island.
You carried me through the mountains?
Hell no. We simply lashed your ass to a litter and dragged you along behind our new horses.
Oh. Sekhmen came after the cats arrived.
Yep. 8 outriders. We skinned the cats and hid under the pelts, then placed some of our spare blasters near the bloody corpses to make them resemble us. Well, kind of, anyway. But in the dark, the Stoops bought the ruse, and when they climbed down for the blasters, we chilled them from behind. Simple as opening a self-heat.
Easy.
A couple of the horses died during the fight, so we only have 6 for the 7 of us. However, Doc was kind enough to offer to share with Liana, and she doesn't seem to mind too much.
Is that horse in the pot?
We butchered what we could carry, but we ate that already. This is hardbacks. I tried to sing for snakes. They arrived instead.
She sang at midnight, and the turtles arrived at dawn, just as we were about to leave. But better late than never.
Rest of the horses out back. Lot of fish, water, and grass.
Along with a lovely little creek, just perfect for bathing. Now that you're awake, it'd be nice to be able to smell the stew instead of you.
That is, unless you plan to conquer North Point by simply flapping your arms, my dear Ryan.
Yeah. Guess I do smell a little like a swampy.
Dead swampy.
Besides, it's almost dark and we can't travel at night. There are too many flapjacks in the area, and the damn things are tough enough to see in broad daylight.
Fair enough.
Rummaging in his pockets, Ryan unearthed a plastic zip-top bag containing a small bar of used soap. It was military soap, without any perfumes or softeners, but it took the dirt off a person slicker than skimming pond scum.
Take your time. The stew will be ready when you come back.
Good to hear. Guess I want everybody ready to leave at first light. Take only the weapons and food. I want to reach North Point by noon tomorrow and get us some transportation off this rat pit of an island.
Steal a boat?
Sure as shit, I'm not going to try to buy one again.
It had been over a day since Baron Griffin last slept, but in his dreams, the man constantly relived the events of that terrible day, over and over. Sleep brought no rest, so he abandoned the thoughts of it and concentrated on something more tangible, like revenge. By now, most of the destruction in the ville had been cleared away, the fires extinguished and the dead buried. Or rather, they had been until the Kraken arrived. With the Sekhmen almost too exhausted to fight, Sec Chief Donovan had devised a brutal new tactic and had the ville folk hurriedly dig up the corpses and throw them to the Mutie. That hadn't been enough, so then he fed the thing to slaves, all of them, and then some of the Vilfolk. Finally, sated, the Kraken had returned to the depths of the sea, leaving the Vil untouched. However, that was not a tactic that the Baron could ever use again. There was nobody else to sacrifice.
All right! Let's try it again! Light the fire!
You heard the Baron!
As most of the Sekhmen backed away to a safe distance, a grim-faced man opened the iron door of the hearth and applied a piece of smoldering oakum to the pile of rags soaked in shine. Instantly, they ignited, and the fire quickly spread through the carefully arranged stack of dry wood, filling the hearth to overflowing. Closing the door on the growing conflagration, the bare-chested man pulled on several levers, and studying the gauges, made sure that the fire had sufficient air. As the temperature climbed, the needle on the repaired pressure gauge steadily rose higher and higher. Licking his dry lips, the man mentally prayed to the moon god. The previous 10 people who had tried this had been horribly killed, cooked alive by the escaping steam, the last one personally killed by the Baron to stop his agonized howling.
We're at 50%, Baron! 70%! 90!
Suddenly, a volcano of steam erupted from the valve on top of the machine, and the transmission lurched into action, wheels turning and rods shifting.
Throw the switch! Throw it!
Making a protective gesture, the man grabbed the big lever and pulled it all the way back. The rebuilt Wendigo rolled out of the repair cradle, smashing aside the wooden supports in an explosion of hemp rope and splinters. Battered and bruised, the dirty repair crew marveled as the armored war wag rolled across the Vil, methodically, but moving faster than ever before. The man at the controls beamed widely.
It works! By the lost gods, we did it! The son of a bitch thing works!
All right! Mount up! We roll! Right fucking now!
To North Point!
Dashing eagerly around, they grabbed their weapons and climbed into the saddles of their horses, every mind filled with savage thoughts of bloody revenge. After breakfasting at dawn, the companions packed away everything useful and buried the campfire, first under dirt and rocks, then dry leaves, to try to disguise the fact that they had ever been there. Checking the belly strap of the mare he had been given, Ryan heartily approved of the mount. Elvira wasn't the biggest horse of the bunch. Doc got the big stallion to support the double load of him and Liana. But Ryan's mare was clearly bridle-wise and had the look of a seasoned warhorse. This was not a horse that would buck and throw him off at the first sound of gunfire. However, Ryan would have to be extremely careful of where the animal walked. With metal in such short supply on the island, there were no horseshoes. Unshod hooves had a tendency to bruise, and then the horse would be lame for a week, which meant that one wrong move and Ryan was on foot again. Although seriously impatient to be underway, Ryan still spent several minutes stroking Elvira's muscular neck. As he checked the straps on the saddlebags, Ryan noticed that his Desert Eagle was gone, then saw it tucked into Jack's gun belt. Carter didn't mind the loan. He already had two guns, and that was enough for him. Leaving the campsite, the companions crossed a misty field of grass at an easy lope, letting the animals warm to the work of the day. In a few hours, they encountered a wide field of wheat, the tufted stalks waving gently in the cool breeze. There were no rows or furrows anymore, no tractors, plows, or silos. Any sign of cultivation was long gone. The grain grew random, choking itself in some areas, and was painfully thin in others, the ever-present fog giving the landscape a faintly surreal appearance. Grabbing handfuls of the stalks as they rode along, the companions wisely tucked the grain away to feed the horses later. There was plenty of grass, but wheat had more protein, and the animals would need all of their strength soon enough. With Liana's directions, JB's use of the sextant and map, and Ryan's telescope, the companions found the dried river by noon. Several yards wide, it began at the base of a dead waterfall, the bare rock of the cliff tinged with green moss. Snaking away, the riverbed meandered through the rolling hills, forming a natural highway that disappeared into a mist-shrouded forest of elm and pine trees.
The Sekhmen say in the spring this is all whitewater. Impossible to cross because of the muddy fish that swim upstream to breed at the falls.
That's probably what the flapjacks normally feed upon.
Stopping to light torches made of wooden table legs wrapped in oil-soaked rope, the group proceeded down the sloping bank and onto the cracked mosaic of dried mud. Both banks grew steadily higher, the grassland giving way to thorny brambles and then a dense forest. Overhead, the branches reached out to almost touch, forming a cathedral effect, the dappled light sprinkling the ground with pinpoints. Keeping a tight hold on the reins of their nervous mounts, the companions rode slowly along, everybody holding a torch as high as they could. The firelight banished the shadows, and the thick smoke wafted into the canopy of overlapping branches. There was no sign of the flapjacks, but there was constant movement in the treetops wherever the smoke touched. Staying sharp, the companions kept a close watch on the greenery, their hands never far from a loaded firearm, until the forest was far behind them, lost in the cottony fog bank. Slow hours passed, and it was late afternoon when they crested a hill, and the companions slowed their mounts at the sight of farmland, rows of leashed slaves digging in the dark loam with their bare hands, while fat overseers occasionally lashed out with a whip to make the men and women work faster. Only one guard was mounted, the gun boot of his saddle filled with a feathered lance. The Sekhmen were dressed in warm furs and heavy boots, while the slaves were in rags, mud covering most of the skinny bodies as crude protection from the afternoon chill. Ratty canvas bags full of seeds were suspended from the wooden yokes around their throats, and they crawled along, kneading the earth to plant a single seed, then moving forward a few inches to endlessly repeat the process.
Look alive, you glebes! The winter snow will be here soon, and without the clover as ground cover, there'll be no food in the spring!
Lesson we eat you!
Nah, don't bother talking to them. Slaves be too stooped to understand them.
The fat overseer reeled in the saddle, killed instantly, the barbed point of an arrow sticking up the side of his head. And then he slipped off the horse to fall face down into the furrows. Spinning fast, the other two guards jumped at the sight of the mounted companions.
Sound the alarm!
The Sek woman doubled over, clutching the arrow that protruded from her stomach, frantically clawing inside his jacket for his whistle. The last overseer's belly was burst open with a blast. Stumbling backward, the guard tripped over a furrow and went sprawling. In a mad rush, the slaves swarmed over the overseer, pounding him with rocks, their strong fingers ripping at his clothing. Trying to pull a wooden machete, the overseer disappeared within the mob, and soon warm red blood flowed along the cold ground. Jack spun on his horse and glared at Liana, while Doc lowered his lama.
Why you do that? If overseers disappear, we'll go on alert.
Kin helps kin.
Quite right, my dear. Freeing slaves is always laudable. However, you should have consulted with us first before acting. Now we must continue on foot.
Why? There are no more Sekhmen in sight.
That we know about.
You know, the horses will help the slaves get away faster. And the more Sekhmen that go after them, the less there'll be to protect the dockyard.
This may actually make it easier to steal the boat.
Maybe or maybe not. But now we have no choice in the matter. We gotta help them to help ourselves.
Can't take them on a boat anyway.
Depends on the size of the boat.
But Liana, if you ever do something this stupid again...
You either with us or not. Make your choice.
I choose Doc. I stand with Theophilus.
Trying not to smile, Doc reached out to gently touch her shoulder, speaking volumes without saying a word. Darkness slowly descended, then the full moon rose, bathing the island with its clean, silvery illumination. The surface of the bay was calm, the gentle waves lapping listlessly against the thick wooden pylons of the dock. There were no cicadas to disturb the stillness, no owls, wolves, or winged muties. After the Kraken attack a few days earlier, everything had fled the area, leaving the ville by the bay in unaccustomed peace and quiet. The docks were deserted that time of night, the fishing done for the day. A score of heavily patched nets hung from racks to dry. The barge poles and oars were stashed away safely in wicker lockers, the ropes neatly coiled, hawsers and wooden pulleys swaying from raised hoists. Extending along the entire waterfront of North Point, the dockyard was full of different-sized boats, each expertly moored to stone cleats with thick hemp ropes, small birch-bark canoes, rowboats covered with elaborate symbols of protection, a few crude barges used for hauling lumber across the wide bay, and, of course, the Warhammer. Several times the size of even a cargo barge, the mighty Warhammer dominated the dockyard. The freshly scrubbed gunwale gleamed, and there were lovingly tended rows of pre-dark car tires lashed to the painted hull to prevent it from becoming damaged by rubbing against the reinforced pylons. Carved deep into the hull was the proud name of the vaunted warship. The hull was studded with thick planks of dense wooden armor, the sides bristling with long spears. Even the mooring line sparkled in the dim moonlight from the shards of glass woven into the tough fibers. Plus, strategically placed around the deck were large canvas mounds, one at the front and two at the back, the material lashed down tight as protection from even the fiercest storm. A large metal smokestack rose from the middle of the warhammer, cutting through the end of a small wheelhouse. However, there was nobody inside to stand a turn at the circular helm at the moment, and the spacious glass windows looked across the shimmering waves of the bay with unseeing eyes. Edging the dockyard, the wall of the nearby vill inadvertently blocked some of the moonlight at this hour, a thin slice of darkness masking the base of the massive barrier. Standing like black giants, the guard towers rose over the slumbering vill. On the boardwalk of the dock, overlooking the warhammer, a Sekhman was sitting on a small keg. Wearing a long coat of thick fur, he was armed with a crossbow, a half arrow already notched into place, ready for instant use. There was a small whistle hanging from a cord around his left wrist. There hadn't been any trouble with the Hillies or Outlanders for several months, which meant it was just about time for them to try to sneak into the vill to see what could be jacked. Just then, the Sekhman felt a sharp pain, and he quickly expired, the weapon falling from his limp fingers. A ghostly pale hand caught the crossbow before it hit the dock, and a pair of strong arms grabbed the dying man to prop him back up on the keg. Sitting the corpse on top, Ryan lashed the warm body into place with some rope, then slipped back into the night to join Jack in the gloom under the dock. Creeping along the mossy beam supporting the boardwalk, the two companions approached the warhammer. Ready and waiting, Doc already had a loose plank prepared, retrieved from a dry dock only 100 paces away near the trees. Working together, the three men eased it upward from the blackness to rest on the gunwale of the warship. It settled into place, and they tensely waited for any reactions from additional guards on board. No Baron would ever trust a single Sekhman with a treasure like the warhammer. Sure enough, a few minutes later, the door of the wheelhouse opened, exposing a grumpy Sekhman armed with a spear and carrying a lantern.
Fucking rats.
He shuffled along, the lantern held low, and the spear raised high to strike. Without a pause, Jack threw a leaf-bladed knife, which pierced the man's heart. Doc darted out to grab the spear and the lantern. The Sekhman seemed to deflate, easing slowly to the deck before becoming still. While Jack stood guard, Ryan took the body and lowered it over the gunwale. Christy and JB took the corpse and dragged it out of sight. Moving stealthily, the rest of the companions gathered on the aft deck of the boat, then separated to start a fast wreck. Several more Sekhmen were found inside the craft, including a cook tending to a stew on the galley stove, and one by one, they were noiselessly dispatched. Finished with the wheelhouse, the companions proceeded down the stairs and into the hold. This part of the vessel clearly belonged to the Baron. Everything on the boat was elaborately carved, mostly scenes of the Lady Baron defeating giant muties and standing triumphant on top of a mound of her fallen enemies. Mildred had to smile at the classic propaganda. Even in a land where nobody could read, the government still found a way to feed the people a steady diet of bullshit. At the bow was a large room with a feather bed and a well-stocked liquor cabinet, plus a small assortment of crossbows and knives. Knowing that Barons always kept a gun nearby, JB searched the headboard of the bed, and sure enough, found a sliding panel. Nestled inside the hidey hole were two loaded flintlock pistols, and wonders of wonders, a fully functional 9mm Mac-10 machine pistol in excellent shape. There was even a spare magazine. Warily inspecting the weapon, JB scowled in disgust.
Shit, stupid bitch.
The Baron had left both of the magazines fully loaded, and who knew how long they had been waiting here? Most likely, the springs in the magazines would be weak by now, and the rapid fire would jam after only a few rounds. However, the brass seemed in fine condition. Experimentally, JB cut open a round to make sure it was packed with gunpowder.
That's more like it.
And was delightedly surprised to find that it held pre-dark propellant, the good stuff. Happily, the armorer extracted all of the 9mm rounds and split the windfall with Ryan to use in his Sig Sauer, while Doc got the black powder for his Lamaw. Going down to the engine room, the companions found the fuel bunkers fully stocked with dried wood, along with dozens of small kegs full of what smelled like rancid fish oil. Easily filling half of the hold was a colossal steam engine, the boiler patently recovered from a factory or apartment house that still used steam heating radiators. Looking over the machinery, Ryan nodded in grudging approval. The conversion was actually very clever. Junk parts from 100 machines combined to make a functioning engine for the warship. Ryan's opinion of Baron Wainwright went up a few notches. Whatever else the woman might be, she was no fool. Laying a hand on the iron side of the boiler, Christy found it ice cold, and checking the firebox underneath, she saw that it was spotlessly clean.
This'll take hours to get hot and build up enough pressure.
Then you better get busy. Liana, get back to the galley and burn the stew. That should help disguise any smoke coming from the furnace.
With a nod, Liana turned and dashed up the stairs.
I'll start chopping wood.
Doc tucked away the Lama and pulled an axe from a chopping block. He was pleasantly surprised to find it was from before Skydark, the head made of steel. Luckily, it was razor sharp.
Make the pieces small. That'll make them burn faster.
Jack rolled a keg of fish oil closer to the boiler. Taking the kindling, he dipped it into the reeking oil, then tossed the damp pieces into the firebox. Going to a porthole, Ryan swung back the louvered hatch and looked outside. There was no visible movement from the nearby Vill, either along the top of the wall or in the guard towers. But he knew that could change at a moment's notice.
How soon till we're mobile?
A couple of hours at least. This is like no steam engine I've ever seen before.
All right, we better get ready to defend this tub. Mildred, help Doc and Jack get that boiler started. Christy, stand guard by the porthole. If anybody comes this way, chill him with a crossbow. Then let us know.
No problem.
Christy holstered her gun and swung around the crossbow. She knew there had been a reason Ryan said to bring one along. Sniper duty. She expertly tested the drawstring before working the pump to notch a half arrow. She knew the range wasn't very good, so she would have to let them get close before taking them out.
I'll go see if there are any maps of the bay in the tub. It's a bastard maze out there, and if we hit a sandbar, we'll never live long enough to get free again.
Got that right.
Will you be conducting a reconnaissance of the Vill, my dear Ryan?
Hell no. I'm gonna see what's hidden under those canvas sheets.
Dawn was just starting to lighten the sky when a man-sized door opened in the seawall of North Point Vill, and out walked a sec man wrapped in a heavy bearskin coat. There was a bamboo fishing pole resting on his shoulder, and he was carrying a wicker basket full of freshly baked bread. He ambled toward the sleeping guard sitting on the barrel at the end of the dock.
Hey, wake up, shithead. Better not let the Baron catch you snoozing on post, or have your balls for breakfast. Oh, shit!
He realized then the subterfuge. Dropping everything, the sec man reached for the whistle lashed to his wrist. Throwing back his head, the man clawed at the arrow in his throat, fired from the warhammer. Staggering from the pain, he tried to head for the Vill, but tripped over the fishing pole and tumbled off the dock into the bay. Quickly rising into view on the warship, Doc and Jack appeared from behind the gunwale and released the mooring lines. Only seconds later, the warship began to sluggishly move away from the dockyard. Stepping out of the wheelhouse, Ryan went directly to the forward deck and yanked off the canvas sheet to reveal a honeycomb of bamboo pipes joined together with stout rope and mounted on a platform atop a swivel post.
Light it up, lover!
Ryan flicked a butane lighter into life and ignited a stubby fuse at the back of the weapon. Already at the second launcher on the aft deck, Christy did the same thing. And then the two companions impatiently waited for what seemed to be an inordinate length of time for the fuses to finally reach the cluster of bamboo pipes. When the fuse vanished inside the honeycomb, there was a gush of smoke and a rocket flew away, streaking over the dockyard to slam into the wall of the Vill and violently explode. Then the first of Christie's rockets launched to punch through the largest fishing boat moored at the dock. Spraying sparks and smoke, the rocket punched through the wooden hull and lanced into the water, leaving behind a bubbling contrail. Grabbing the heavy yoke of the honeycomb, Ryan moved the launcher into a new position just as the second rocket took off. However, it spiraled past the wall. It missed the guard tower by a few feet. Exerting all of his strength, Ryan held the launcher still. The third rocket flew true, and the guardhouse detonated into flame and splinters, falling bodies arching down into the sleepy Vill. gushing black fumes from the smokestack, the Warhammer steadily chugged away from the shore and began slipping into a vaporous cloud of mist covering the middle of the bay. Knowing she had only a few moments of sight remaining, Christie quickly swung her yoke around to aim rocket after rocket at anything that might be able to give pursuit. In short order, canoes, fishing boats, and barges were blown to smithereens, the wreckage swiftly sinking to the bottom of the bay. Meanwhile, Ryan took out the second guard tower, then the third. Inside the wheelhouse, JB saw no reason to be covert anymore. Taking a hand off the wheel, he pulled on the dangling rope of the steam whistle. Out of sinkable targets, Christie added the power of her honeycomb to Ryan's. The homemade rockets hammered the dock non-stop, blowing out pylons and crashing through the boardwalk. Then they ruthlessly aimed the weapons at the one door of the Ville wall, catching a squad of armed SecMen totally by surprise. They were blasted into hamburger by the double salvo, the door itself blown off the hinges before the thickening fog masked the Ville completely.
You get them all?
No, this was it. We must keep most of the rockets inside the Ville. You know, just in case somebody jacks the boat.
Do you think they will give pursuit?
I would.
Suddenly, something huge flashed past the warship to slam into the surface of the lake, throwing off a geyser of water.
Arbalest!
Ryan leveled the Steyr, but it was impossible to see through the morning fog. That was why they had chosen this time to leave instead of at night. Only now, the fog that shielded them was doing the same for the Ville SecMen. Several more of the giant arrows came out of the mist, slashing across the bay in different directions. Most of them only sliced into the water, but one hit a sandbar, violently exploding into a geyser of splinters and loose sand. The Warhammer moved steadily along, trying to get as far away from the Ville as possible without approaching any of the countless sunken trees or small sandbars. For several minutes, the vessel steamed along, rapidly increasing speed, until there was a jarring impact that threw everybody to the deck as the warship suddenly stopped.
Fucking hell, we ran aground!
Never letting go of the wheel, JB grabbed a speaking tube made of joined sections of bamboo and shouted into the mouthpiece.
Jack! Reverse the engine! Give me dead slow!
Slowly, the engine eased in tempo, and the trembling in the hull stopped. The propeller spun for an inordinately long time before the Warhammer sluggishly pulled itself loose. The water swirled darkly around the boat, then gradually cleared as it moved backward into deep water again.
Liana, are there any man-eaters in the bay? Can we swim out ahead to check for more obstacles?
None. Only the sea. The lake has killer fish.
That won't help. The bastard sandbar we just hit was too far underwater to see. Swimming ahead of the boat would only slow us more.
Ah, but mayhap I can show us the way.
Keep us still for a moment, John Barrymore, while I find some string!
String?
String!
Doc disappeared down the stairwell. A few moments later, he returned with a slim length of hemp rope coiled in his hands. Going to the bow, he stretched the rope out to the length of his arm and tied off a knot. He kept doing that for the whole length of the rope. Then he went back and added a larger knot between each of the arm's length knots. Looking for something to use as a plumb, Doc found nothing serviceable and reluctantly tied the Ruger to the end of the rope. At least it was waterproof and would not be damaged by a long immersion, unlike the precious Lama.
Clever. Very clever, you old coot.
My parents had a fool for a son, but that was my brother.
Doc tossed the rope overboard. The revolver sank out of sight, and Doc let the knotted rope run through his fingers until it stopped descending.
John Barrymore! We have 10 feet to the port side! Is that sufficient?
The what side?
Port has 4 letters, just like the word left.
Ah, gotcha. Yeah, 10 is fine. Jack, move us forward at half speed. No, make that a third.
A few seconds later, the vessel began to creep forward again. Casting out the line again, Doc reeled it in quickly and read the depth.
Mark! Half twain to the starboard!
Dark night, speak English, Doc!
Full twain means clear sailing. Half twain means the water's getting shallow. Quarter twain means danger, slow and back off!
Well, why doesn't he just say so?
Tradition, my friend!
With Doc leading the way, JB clumsily steered the bulky vessel through the sandy maze of the narrow channel. Progress was slow. Ryan stayed a tense guard at the back of the boat, the Steyr clenched in both hands as he strained to see into the wafting fog. Slow hours passed, and the noon sun began to bake away the cool morning mist when the Warhammer finally entered a wide area of the bay, the clear blue water dotted with a series of small islands that strongly resembled the fjords of Norway.
It should be clear sailing from here on.
About damn time.
Okay, Jack, give me full speed.
Are those cannons?
I hope so. No, it's a timing drum. Fire blast. I thought we sank everything they had.
Guess we missed one. There must have been a dry dock or a boatyard that Liana didn't know about.
I saw a vid once about Roman galleys. Mostly they use slaves, but during a war, sometimes Sekhmen would crew the ships. 50, 60, 100 strong men rowing in perfect unison. The oars moving to the beat of a timing drum.
How fast did they move?
Very fast. Too damn fast. With a properly trained crew, a galley could easily catch a windjammer near the shore and ram into it hard enough to crash through, completely through, coming out the other side. The Romans didn't have to fire an arrow or draw a single sword. They just plowed the other ship down like roadkill and let the sea do the rest.
How far did Liana say it was until we reached the open lake?
50 more miles, just past a peninsula. Think we'll make it before they arrive?
We'll find out soon enough.